Unfortunately, I didn't bring an avatar with me, but I could. Anyway, I do think there's been some issues which I think Paul and I think Ted could elaborate on during the plenary session this afternoon. However, because we did run over time, I have to be brutal with the next three speakers. And so, as they do at the College Art Association, they turn the mic off after your 20-minute. But yes, it's very tough here. So anyway, it's my pleasure. There's three noted speakers this afternoon in this session. And the first is Leon Marvel. And Leon is an associate professor in film and digital media at Deakin University. Over to you.
Like Brad, I'm in a strange state. I have three conferences in a row. I've just come from Bangkok, and then after this I drive from the airport in Melbourne to Geelong. And in my haste to become organised, something that I'm not used to, all my material for three different presentations and three linked, related, but different conferences, I forgot the most crucial element of my presentation today. I'm talking about the production of a short film loop I made last year, and I did not bring a copy of the film loop with me. So you will not be able to see what I'm talking about, which might be a good thing, because it means that all of you, in your own minds, will generate your own version of the film that I'm about to talk about. So I'm very sorry for that. I don't have any other presentation. I did like the approximation of International Klein Blue we had up there before. Maybe we could get that back. Anyway. All right. My presentation is called The Pineal Eye and the Matrixial Void. And I start with a quotation from Ezra Pound. "The image is not an idea. It is a radiant node or cluster. It is what I can and must perforce call a vortex, from which and through which and into which ideas are constantly rushing." That is, of course, taken from the Vorticist's manifesto. It is my aim in this paper to illuminate the quotation through elaborating an anagogic reading of the production of a short film loop of mine called El Castillo Interior. To do this, I first need to explain what might be considered the axiomatics, the grounds, that which is assumed of my discussion. Firstly, what do I mean by the word anagogic? Nowadays, the term anagogic refers almost exclusively to the explication of mystical readings of religious texts. My use of the word is much more loose, however, even approaching the colloquial, or at least a common usage that was once in favour. It's now probably a bit antique. In terms of this paper, anagogic simply means mysterious considerations, considerations that are speculative, sometimes counterintuitive, and certainly radically tangential to what is rather lamely called materialist analyses of cultural production these days. Secondly, although I do not have the time to elaborate upon the conviction here, I take it for granted that human consciousness is fundamentally participatory with the cosmos, even though this participation may not ordinarily be accessible to quotidian consciousness. This position allows me to explore the liminal space between actor and object, artist and idea, idea and matter. This in-between space constitutes both the virtual and actual space of my discussion, in and around the production of the film loop El Castillo Interior, the one playing in your minds now. Lastly, the aforementioned liminal space can justifiably be characterized as a metaphysical presumption, and that is certainly fine by me. Elsewhere, I have noted the unjustifiable dereliction of metaphysics in late 20th century thought, so I think it is about time that we acknowledge that there is no outside to metaphysics, as Derrida was at pains to point out. And I will here explore and embrace the notion of a speculative aesthetics. About 2 years ago, I was searching the internet for some item or other when a pop-up window appeared advertising an adult website. As I'm sure you will agree, this is hardly an unusual occurrence for anybody who surfs the web. But what was unusual in this instance was the short moving image that accompanied the advertisement and which grabbed my attention. The image was a slightly blurred film loop of a woman in what one supposes was a hot tub, with only her head and shoulders moving above the swirling water. At first she smiles at the camera, then her attention withdraws and she, at least it seemed to me, begins to move with the water itself, this movement culminating in a look of contemplative ecstasy. St. Teresa, I thought. Quickly I searched my computer cache for the cached image and dragged it to my desktop. Now that I had a version of the moving image, I left it on the desktop for a few days and finally put it away in a folder and forgot about it for a great period of time. Anybody who has seen Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa, either in the flesh, as it were, or in photographic reproduction, will know immediately why the name flashed into my consciousness, and you'll see what I mean when you look at the film. The girl in the film clip closes her eyes and opens her mouth ever so slightly, almost exactly as Bernini imagines St. Teresa doing in his famous sculpture. I was well aware that the real St. Teresa, the historical saint, had written a mystical work called El Castillo Interior, so I eventually set upon finding the equivalent of this interior castle in the interior of the image I had accidentally found. This is what I mean. Within any image there is a history, or perhaps more precisely, une histoire, a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. This story, the image's history, is the equivalent of what physicists call its phase space. This phase space includes all the putative moments that constitute the image, from the very first brush stroke on the canvas to the varnished, finished work hanging in a gallery or rotting in some dusty atelier. An image is a olon, ancient Greek word, a whole, which, if we had the appropriate tools, we could unravel into an extended timeline and examine its beginnings, its middle, and its final culmination as, well, Rembrandt's Night Watch or Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa. This manner of regarding the image is, of course, not medium-specific. It can apply to any iconic reproduction in any medium, including digital film. One cannot, however, just think the image out. No amount of meditation on the image of the girl in the hot tub would bring the Castillo Interior out of the image, if it was in fact in there at all. I had to work to bring it out, push the matter of the image about, subject it to dilution, smear it, mould it, reconstitute it. This is what Rembrandt did on a daily basis, as did Bernini. This is what artists do when they produce an image. They get their hands dirty with turpentine and pigment or shards of marble and plaster dust. In my case, I had to get dirty with pixels and software, virtual buttons and sliders, so I came out relatively looking good at the end of the day. James Elkins, in What Painting Is, has characterized the production of an image in this way. To an artist, a picture is both a sum of ideas and a blurry memory of pushing paint, breathing fumes, dripping oils and wiping brushes, smearing and diluting and mixing. Material memories are not usually part of what is said about a picture, and that is a fault in interpretation, because every painting captures a certain resistance of paint, a prodding gesture of the brush, a speed and insistence in the face of mindless matter. Elkins goes on to compare this form of activity to that of alchemy in order to answer the question, what is thinking in painting as opposed to thinking about painting? For Elkins, this is much more than just a simple analogy. Painting and alchemy are sister pursuits because, as he says, paint is water and stone, and it is also liquid thought. There is an auric glow within pixels too, as anyone with an open mind will attest, and the pursuit of the philosopher's stone can just as easily be enacted with the matter of the computer, its software, its hardware, its inputs and outputs, as it can with quicksilver and sulfur. Mine was an alchemical process too. In manipulating the image, I was thinking in and with the image, not thinking about it. The pineal eye. This metaphysical plunge into the vortex of the image that I'm attempting to elucidate can only be accomplished through the activation of a dormant parietal eye that I will call, with deference to Georges Bataille, the pineal eye. This organ will not, of course, be recognised by any contemporary neurosurgeon, yet that shouldn't prevent one from speculating as to its particular mode of functioning. Bataille's the pineal eye and its sister text, the solar anus, are orgiastic, scatological, scabrous, and undisciplined, like all the very best of his work. And it is not my intention here, unfortunately, to engage in an in-depth reading of either of them. Rather, I want to engage with the spirit of these two texts, and that is a spirit of inversion, mirroring, and mythopoetic thinking, as opposed to a linear, anatomizing analysis. In an orgiastic reverie, Bataille dreamed of a new propensity with him, and I quote, "The eye that I wanted to have at the top of my skull, since I read that its embryo existed, like the seed of a tree in the interior of the skull, did not appear to me as anything other than a sexual organ of unheard-of sensitivity, which would have vibrated, making me let out atrocious screams, the screams of a magnificent but stinking ejaculation." Bataille's notion of a peculiarly sensitive, sexualized eye within the skull is reminiscent of another eccentric idea propounded by Ezra Pound, with whom I began, in his proscript to his translation of Remy de Gourmont's Natural Philosophy of Love. Pound considers that it is, quote, "more than likely that the brain itself is in origin and development only a great clot of genital fluid held in suspense or reserve." And that the effect of this fluidic reserve was, to quote, both a matter of quantity and quality, some animals profiting hardly at all, the baboon retaining nothing, men apparently stupefying themselves in some cases by excess. This would explain, according to him, the enormous content of the brain as a maker or presenter of images. Pound's logic allows him to note that, quote, the power of the spermatozoid is precisely the power of exteriorizing a form. This notion of a phalloencephalon evolved to produce stupefaction by excess and excess of images would no doubt have been enthusiastically received by Bataille himself. As one writer has it, Bataille's pineal eye is, quote, the primitive cosmogonic vision of the sun as an orifice of the human body, thus of sky as the outer or inner surface of another much vaster body, to the wildness, violence, randomness, freedom of a modern poesis in which virtually any metaphoric connection or copulation is possible. In Solar Anus, Bataille writes, and when I scream, I am the sun, an integral erection results, because the verb to be is the vehicle of amorous frenzy. Everyone is aware that life is parodic and that it lacks an interpretation. Thus, lead is a parody of gold. Air is a parody of water. The brain is the parody of the equator. Coitus is a parody of crime. Gold, water, the equator, or crime, each put forward as a principle of things. Each can be put forward as a principle of things. And if the origin of things is not like the ground of the planet that seems to be the base, but like the circular movement that the planet describes around a mobile centre, then a car, a clock, or a sewing machine could equally be accepted as a generative principle. In this passage, Bataille adumbrates the complex that is the pineal eye. Let me attempt to reconnect this complex in another way. This vibrating organ of unheard-of sensitivity produces an integral erection, that is, an integrative verticality that mythopoetically links the earth, the heavens, and the human corporeity in an amorous frenzy, something I imagine is akin to the divine madness or heroic frenzy of Giordano Bruno or Ficino, remembering that heroic, of course, is etymologically related to the word eros. There is more here, however. Bataille characterizes the activity of the pineal eye as a kind of alchemical organ where all kinds of matter, gold, water, the equator, a car, a clock, or perhaps Lautremont's sewing machine, can equally be considered as generative principles. One should note that the English words genesis, generation, genital, and knowledge all share the same Proto-Indo-European root word "n," having the meaning of to know or to understand. The unlikely set of generative principles that Bataille invokes are, to my mind at least, akin to the archae or elementary principles of alchemy, the practical pursuit of which sought to reveal knowledge of an unheard-of sensitivity within an integrative, amorous frenzy, which, of course, Bataille did not say, yet I think is a valid reading of his texts. In the passage above, Bataille conflates all manner of things into a singular stuff, not the dull, lifeless stuff of Descartes' res extensa, but the kind of alive matter, the matter of literally infinite potential that was the stuff of the European alchemists and their forebears in the great centres of alchemical learning of Islam and Taoism. This alchemical stuff is also the stuff of the matrixial void. In an important alchemical text, Truth's Golden Harrow, by the English Paracelsian doctor and alchemist Robert Fludd, the question of stuff is discussed in terms of 17th century intellectual debate. It's a critique of another alchemical text called The Tillage of Light, in which it was maintained that the philosopher's stone was not a material substance, but an immaterial entity entirely spiritual in nature. Fludd, perhaps because he was a medical doctor, contrarily maintained that the philosopher's stone was a material substance. The primal stuff, or philosophical il, as he called it, was anagogically similar to water, the same stuff referred to by Moses when he states that the earth was out form and void, the formless void, being Fludd's philosophical il. Aristotle identified his term il with the receptacle, the hyperdike, or cora of Plato's Timaeus, and Fludd did too. Plato defined the receptacle as the nurse of all becoming and the natural matrix of all things, adding that the hyperdike is a receiver without any qualities of its own. As Alfred North Whitehead has interpreted this, the receptacle receives its forms by reason of its inclusion of all that exists, and in a way not to be abstracted from all that exists. Whitehead says, the receptacle is the way in which Plato conceived the many actualities of the physical world as components of each other's natures. This mutual immanence of actualities is Plato's doctrine of the medium of intercommunication. So Flood's alchemical conception of the hyperticke is identical with Moses' formless void, also presages Whitehead's interpretation, in that Whitehead thinks that while the Platonic receptacle and the Lucretian void differ in some details, both conceptions, according to him, are emphatic assertions of a real communication between ultimate realities. It is part of the essential nature of each physical actuality that it is in itself an element qualifying the receptacle, and that the qualifications of the receptacle enter into its own nature. In Whitehead's view, the hyperticke represents the first appearance in the West of a model of universal intercommunication, or in layman's terms, everything interacts with everything else. Which returns me, like the uberous serpent, to the nature of things as perceived by the pineal eye. For Bataille states that all things would, to quote, all things would visibly be connected if one could discover at a single glance and in its totality the tracing of an Ariadne's thread leading thought into its own labyrinth. The pineal eye, then, is a manner of looking, operating, that recognises the totality of a situation, the entire story, the phase space. And in this phase space, there is a breaking hypersurface embedded in a higher dimensional space, which Plato called the receptacle, just as current cosmological membrane theory reimagines. Finally, il castillo interior. Is that my time, or is that just your... Okay. El castillo interior is not the result of some willed activity, this film you have in your minds, just as is imagined to typically occur, for example, in a life drawing class, where one imposes one's will, as it were, on the drawing surface. Rather, this short film loop is the explicit emblem of the unfolding of a phase space that began when I chanced upon the original image on the internet. I certainly did not set out to produce El Castello Interior through some sort of well-honed artistic practice. On the contrary, I searched for something that I hoped was there already. In a very real sense, the series of procedures that produced El Castillo Interior were already within the original image, invaginated within it. The one became many, the many were combined into one. The moving image, the explicate emblem, is a kind of dynamic hieroglyph. It was not constituted by my deliberative actions, but rather by the intersection of experimental procedures on my part and the cumulative responses of the apparatus. The apparatus should be conceived of as a totality, the totality of myself, the computer, the software, the logic of play, and our combined interactivities. This is a complex phase space processing what Erwin Schrödinger called Verschrankung, entanglement. The collapse of the wave state occurred when I pressed save on my computer. I would sum it all up in this manner. The nature of poesis, the nature of creation is a series of entailment events within an autopoetic participatory system involving the artisan, aesthetic object, and various levels of interpretive activities. The self-organization, the autopoesis, is the holon, the whole, I mentioned earlier in this paper. Me, the machine, and the matrixial void conspired together in the dynamics of the phase space. This autopoetic holon is immanent and virtual. And I'll quote an eccentric colleague of mine at the University of Western Sydney. Self-organization is a virtual property of interactive nonlinear dynamics. It becomes actual when the dynamics are materialized in some substance and their intensity of interaction increases so that they become swirling, vortical. Which, of course, brings me back to where I began, with Pound's idea of the image as a vortex. El Castillo Interior is just such a vortex, the result of self-propelling feedback loops that, quote, tend to form a vortex-like whirling structure sustained by forces directed towards its centre. Part of this vortex-like whirling structure can be a viewer's interpretations of Il Castillo Interior, those wonderful, profound interpretations you're all holding now in your minds, your own version. These interpretations constitute, again, quote, pulsating vortical layers similar to fractals. An image, therefore, is an event, not a thing. And therefore, a quote from another writer, it is constituted anew each time. Like weather produced in a system around a landmass, the shape of the reading has a codependent relation to the structure from which it arises. It is a highly complex system containing a host of thermal sinks and bases of attraction. So, to see the image anew then, I encourage one to look into the matrixial void with a pineal eye. And there I shall end my presentation, and I shall now turn off the loop.